this is how we do it. I think being a conspiracy kook is not just fun, it's absolutely useful.
Right? I agree.
You have to just be able to tell the difference between speculation and jumping to conclusions and really being right about something, especially when it's predicting how things are going to play out. I don't know. I always thought that if only Yoda had ever just taken a cab, someone would have told him that, like, you know that the Chancellor is the Sith Lord, right? Where do you think the clone army came from? They've been planning this for 10 years, stupid. You know, but instead he's, like, floating around on his little ivory floaty chair, and he never got to hear the words of the people telling him the plain old truth or truth, you know? This is how we do it. It's Friday night,
and I feel all right. The party's here on the west side. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Brett, what kind of a dork in 2018 chooses Montel Jordan for bumper music? Of all the great musical genres, why 90s hip-hop and R&B? Of all the great 90s hip-hop and R&B artists, why Montel Jordan? Of all the great Montel Jordan songs, why This Is How We Do It? I understand your questions, and let me convert them into an opportunity to tell you a story. I've always wanted to have Scott Horton on the podcast, and there's a considerable overlap in our audiences. Scott used to do anti-war radio. He now does the Scott Horton Show. He is a very well-known and widely respected author, broadcaster, and foreign policy and international relations analyst. And he's been in the game a long time, even though this isn't a fucking game. Don't have time for games. But Scott's been doing this work since the 1990s. And in my opinion, he's one of the leading foreign policy analysis voices in the world. So yeah, lots of overlap in audiences, not a lot of overlap in topics of discussion. So I never really pursued Scott as a guest. And then a unique opportunity was presented to me. One of the organizers at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, at which Scott and I were both speakers, Joe Motard. And let me tell you, this is the greatest guy. And I'm going to talk about him more in the next show. But Joe was shuttling Scott to the airport to catch a flight back to Austin. He had flown in to Michigan in the morning just to speak at this event, and then he was flying out again in the evening. So Joe invited me to ride along in the car, an opportunity that would give me 35 minutes to get inside the mind and mindset of Scott Horton. And that's what we did. So through this, I get a brief but interesting behind-the-scenes look at the work and life of Scott Horton. And it turns out that Scott gets pumped up for speeches by listening to 90s R&B. If you have good enough speakers or headphones, you will actually hear perhaps some of your favorites playing in the background throughout this discussion. But when I did hit record, the song playing was Montel Jordan's This Is How We Do It. And I wanted to bring that experience that I had to you. Not that I need to justify any of my musical choices at this point, folks. Then, somehow, Scott missed his flight from Grand Rapids to Austin, so you'll get to enjoy two bonus questions that we recorded as Joe sped back to the campground where the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest was being held to drop me off and then turn around and speed from the middle of nowhere to Detroit in hopes that Scott could catch the connecting flight while it was laid over there. And this is just one of the amazing things that Joe Motard did during this event. And like I said, more to come on that. So Scott and I speed through a variety of topics, and I walked away from this feeling very pleased that I got to see, and you will get to see, a side of Scott that is not always available through the radio show. And also you'll get to learn a little bit about his workflow and his process in the amazing work that he does. In this event that we both attended, the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, it was a highlight of my year so far. I made some really amazing, potentially life-changing connections with people. I will be there next year, and I'm going to do the best I can to get more people like me with podcasts to attend this event. But I'm trying to beat the clock today. I realize this is the first show in 2 weeks. I'm sorry about that. There was no internet there. No uploading could be done. But I'm now back in Pittsburgh, and I'm ready to deliver some content to you. So we'll talk more about this in the next episode. It's going to be Professor CJ from the Dangerous History Podcast. You can look forward to that coming at the end of the week. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Scott Horton. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And thank you for your patience with me. Take care. Scott Horton, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I think we should set the scene first, because this is one of the more interesting interviews that I've done. We're riding together in a car to an airport. What was the circumstances under which you arrived here at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest today to speak? You flew in and you spoke, sold some books, and you're flying right out?
Yeah, that's pretty much it, unfortunately. And I missed my first flight this morning because of the TSA. But
TSA, how, if we have time?
Well, just they were, first of all, dragging ass, and then they pulled me aside for an extra special pat down and scan my, or whatever, put some liquid on my hands to pretend that they're detecting explosives. It's kind of garbage.
Randomly selected, or because you're Scott Horton?
Oh, no, probably just because I was scowling at them coming through the line, you know? But there were a few other people who missed my same flight, and it was because of them. I mean, and I've been through the Austin airport a hell of a lot of times, but the line this morning was just madness. And the TSA, they don't care. That was what the Delta lady said. The Delta lady was like, well, see, they don't really have customers themselves, and so they don't see any sense of urgency or anything. I'm like, yeah, exactly. She's a libertarian economist and didn't even know it.
Well, I'm glad you made it, and I'm glad I get to be part of this for a little bit. I've wanted to talk to you on the show for a long time because I was a big fan of anti-war back in the day, and I could never find a topic with enough overlap for my audience. But there's tons of overlap between our audiences. And, One of the things that I like to do on my show is find smart people who are trying to solve challenging problems, right? So I could have you on the show and just say, Iraq, go. Syria, go. Afghanistan, go. I mean, that's what your new book is about, primarily, Afghanistan. And what I was hoping is that we could get something a little different, and maybe I'm going to ask you some questions you haven't been asked before. You're certainly not asked regularly about mind and mindset. And I was telling you before we started that, you know, I used to listen to anti-war all the time, and after a couple months of like really steady listening and really trying to have my fingers on the pulse of what was happening with U.S. foreign policy and around the world, I would have to check out. Like, I just didn't feel like I had the constitution to stick with it, but I was always amazed by how you have just done this continuously in one form or another, on the radio, on a podcast, in books, in interviews, for how long now?
Well, my first radio show started in 1998, Say It Ain't So on Free Radio Austin, but I started doing the interview show right as Iraq was falling in April 2003. And it started out, it was a weekly show, the weekend interview show for the first couple of years. And then I guess it was the very beginning of 2007 is when I started doing the daily show. And so I was on Chaos Radio, the pirate radio station in Austin, and on the Liberty Radio Network. And so I did that daily show. And then about 2.5 years ago, I quit doing a live show to write the book. And so probably figure out how to get back on live radio doing something. But it's been 11 years or something, basically, of doing a daily show. I still do between like 5 and 8 interviews a week, or 5 or 10 or something.
What inspired you to start back in 1998 to start doing this? And that's going to lead us into like what's motivated you to continue doing this all these years.
Well, come on. I mean, you used to listen to the show. You know, everybody's wrong about everything except me. And so I'm obligated to scream at them about how wrong and horrible they are until they change. And that's why I'm here.
Is that why you started? Is that what you felt beginning?
I was a cab driver. So, and I always had been into talk radio and whatever. I always really found it powerful and awesome going way back. And then, as a cab driver, and I would always just be so disappointed in the caliber of the radio host. Like, whoever's the clone that comes on after Rush every day in the afternoon is always just such a damn disappointment. And to me, you know, radio airtime is so precious. And to hear people just waste it on complete inanity, I just can't stand it. And in the Bill Clinton years, I still do, I just hate Bill Clinton. I hate him so much. And there was so much just absolute horrible stuff going on. Just the worst. And then it's just like now, right, where they attack over everything wrong, everything that they miss the point, everything that's actually something good about him, or everything, like James Bovard said about the Waco hearings, about the Republicans and the Democrats. It's like watching drunks fight in a bar. They swing and they miss. So I'm driving around and I'm listening to everybody criticizing each other and getting everything wrong and never making the important points at all. And so I decided it's got to be me, man. One way or the other, I'm going to have to do it. And then I got that show on Free Radio Austin. And then once I had a show, I mean, I did my first show about Waco, and it was like, yeah, this is definitely for me. So
would you say that maybe it wasn't Waco, but what was the thing that like perked your ears to you need to pay attention, where you started paying attention to all these radio hosts and what they were saying and what they were presenting and like the facsimile messages and, you know, this idea that somebody needs to come and do this better? But even earlier than that, like, what was it that really kind of attuned you to what was going on in the world?
Well, I mean, I don't know. My parents are Democrats, so I was raised to not respect Reagan. I was born in 76, right? So I was 4 when he was inaugurated. So basically my whole childhood, my whole conscious childhood was Reagan Bush years.
Mm-hmm.
And so luckily, you know, I was not born to parents who worshipped him as so many people did back then. And so I never really felt much pressure to defer to what I was being told by these guys, that kind of thing. And then I was a pretty young teenager when I learned about some of the worst stuff about the CIA torturing Americans and the Army testing germs on Americans and CIA coups and lies behind the wars. And like I say, Ronald Reagan, Mr. Drug War, locking up poor people for using the drugs that he almost personally is in charge of importing.
Right.
At the time and that kind of thing. So, and then, you know, Iraq War I and Waco and Oklahoma City bombing. Which was blamed on one guy when it was him and his 8 friends or whatever that did it, and they let him get away with it because they were all undercover cops or flip states witnesses or informants of one kind or another. And so they covered that up and got away with it.
And, so let's actually pause there before okay. we go any further, and we can kind of get into this a little bit. I've been reading this book about FBI hostage negotiation. One of the things that the guy says is that it was Waco and Ruby Ridge that changed everything for us. And he says that at that point, it was a clean slate. There was pretty much widespread agreement in the FBI that everything they were doing as far as negotiation was concerned was wrong. Internally, there was a lot of discussion that the ATF and the FBI and other government departments were basically, you know, at fault for what happened at Waco. How did, considering the fact that you were already pretty awakened to the problems with the U.S. government in the U.S. and beyond at that point, Waco, Oklahoma City bombing, talk in a little bit of detail about how those things affected you when, I mean, because we're about the same age. I was born in 1977.
Yeah.
And I'm interested because I still wasn't to the point of caring about that.
Well, I mean, I remember when Waco burned. Me and my friend walked into his house, and his mom says, look, they're burning it, they're burning it. And I said, who's burning it? And she goes, well, I don't know. I mean, the TV says that they are.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, they're not showing the back of the house. So my initial reaction was, I just don't believe it. I think the FBI hated these people enough that they were sick and tired of waiting and that they launched this attack. And so, you know, so I'm a skateboarder, too. So, I always have hated cops. I just hate cops. And they hate me. And that's why I hate them, to start. And so I just never believed it. Oh, yeah, these people are a cult and they kill themselves because this fraud who claims that he's Jesus said to and whatever. It was just obvious that they were lying. And, Bill Hicks was a big influence on me, I should say. He died
sure.
in the spring of 94, and it must have been the next day or something that I found that I saw him on the Access Channel, Sane Man. And it was just like, wow, man, I mean, he's so good on so many things and just absolutely has had my very same kind of level of cynicism and approach to analysis of these kinds of questions and whatever. And I just, Rant in E Minor and Arizona Bay and Sane Man, those things were very influential to me back then. And Ron Paul is a big influence on me, too, because Ron Paul showed that you could be, you know, you don't have to be a kook to be into the real truth, the underground truth that nobody's supposed to talk about and whatever. That here's a guy who, you know, really knows what he's talking about. He's a serious doctor, an economist, and he's still with his first wife with no scandals and is a, you know, he's a very decent man and a very sane and rational and grounded and calm gentleman. And then he says, listen, my constituents are far more afraid of the FBI bombing them like what happened at Waco than they are concerned about getting bombed like at what happened at Oklahoma City. And it was just like, because that was the truth. That's what his constituents were telling him. And so he was happy to report it. And just that whole approach, I was just telling the guy that interviewed me a minute ago in there, Lou, the Fiend, about the first time I saw Ron Paul on C-SPAN. He was accusing Bush Sr. of treason for selling chemical weapons to Saddam, even during Desert Shield in the run-up to the invasion.
Right.
And he's got papers in his hand. He's going, look, it's published. And he's not ranting like I would. He's going, Mr. Speaker, it's published in the British papers today, and here's the PDF files. I'll print it out. And we got the receipts here. A Bill Hicks joke. We got the receipts from Saddam's weapons here. And this was a, and then I look down at the bottom of the screen. It says R, Texas, and I'm just like, no way.
Right?
No
yeah,
way.
I said the same thing when I encountered him in 2007.
So that's right. That was the Giuliani moment for everyone else. I had mine exactly 10 years prior.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, but and then he was a huge influence on me too. And so, you know, I was always a little Chuck D and a little John Birch and a little bit of. I wasn't ever right wing, but in terms of my one world order kookology, I was a conspiracy nut, John Birch style conspiracy nut in the 90s.
Yes.
Which I finally got over really right at the turn of the century with the Iraq War. I really came to realize that world federalism under the UN is not the grand strategy here. Whatever it is, it's not. It's world government under the US Pentagon, maybe. But all that Birch stuff was not really right. And I think what's funny is my friend Will Grigg, who I co-founded the Libertarian Institute with, he was probably the number one main reason I was still a kook up until the late date of on the New World Order question, because he was, and he's such a brilliant genius, and I think me and him both really kind of got over it right around the same time.
So are the Birchers arguing primarily that there's like a British or Atlanticist influence, like there's an attempt to basically reunite the British Empire or use the United States as a weapon while the rest of the empire is weakened by the two world wars that they fought in the 20th
century? This is the thing, right, is that it's kind of incoherent conspiracy theory, because on one hand, it's the U.S. and Britain allied together are the world empire ruling the world, just like they say in the history of Cecil Rhodes, and this is what he always wanted, is to realign America and Britain together again, us versus the world and all this. But then we're supposed to believe that at the end they're going to turn all power over to who? Germany and France and Belgium and the continental Europeans? Well, then they will be the masters of Brussels, and they'll send, what, Chinese troops to occupy America?
You mean
ships
through some,
they don't have or something? You know what I mean? So, like, ultimately, if we have a one world empire based out of America, then that's really the New World Order. Their theory is the New World Order is after America falls, after America expends every last bit of our energy forcing this system on the rest of the world, then we're last, and then the one world government under the UN will rule us too. And that's just not where it's at.
So
I did believe that for a long time, because it has a certain kind of pattern and ring to it and whatever, but that's not it.
Well, my theory about it is, I mean, you're familiar with like Tragedy and Hope and Carol Quigley.
I mean, this was my thing in the 90s, was reading None Dare Call It Conspiracy and Tragedy and Hope. And
right. So I think one of the reasons why that's had so much traction is, as far as like the British angle is concerned, is because they were the people through Carol Quigley who wrote the most down. So they produced the best example of the establishing of a world government. But people, I think, latch onto it and make it too British-focused, where it's just kind of an example. What it really is an example of a plan to do it, but how realistic or how successful it is beyond, you know, the Council of Foreign Relations and other organizations like that, who's to say? And you're right, there is quite a bit of incoherence. But you mentioned being a conspiracy kook, Scott, which is the funnest way to be, and eventually you just kind of outgrow it with information in a lot of cases. I think that's a hard thing to do. There's less fun to have. The world starts to become more confusing the more you learn. And I'm kind of wondering what your encounters have been like. When you get up and you present a more detailed picture of what's going on in the Middle East or what happened in 9/11, have you gotten pushback or even hate from, like, the 9/11 crowd or, you know, any sort of NWO crowd for producing some kind of a counter narrative that doesn't fit?
Nah, I mean,
never?
Not really.
Really?
I mean,
okay.
I mean, I'm not going to say never, but I guess I don't really argue about it publicly very much because there's not much to be gained from doing so. I love talking about it in private conversations with people. You know, I predicted 9/11 for years before it happened. I knew this is what they're going to do. I said on the radio in 99, if not 2000, that, yeah, no, I in 1999, well, see, I shouldn't say this because I can't prove this because all of the tapes of my first show are destroyed, stolen, and gone, but...
You've built trust with my audience, so you can say it.
Yeah, yeah, well, I mean, it's true. I did say, look, I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen here, is Governor Bush is going to run for president. He's going to get the nomination. There's no question about it. And then, according to my kook logic at the time, his blood is bluer than Al Gore's. And so he's going to win. Harvard trumps Yale, Skull and Bones trumps whatever the hell Al Gore is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, basically, Prescott Bush the third trumps Al Gore the third, which both of them were the thirds. And so... that was my, you know, logic at the time. And then, in fact, I predicted that, going back to math class in 94, when they first announced Junior was running for governor, I said, see what they're doing? They're running two Bushes for governor this year. So one of them is guaranteed to be in there. And then that just means, obviously, the Republicans are going to throw the election to 96 and make sure that Bush, one of the Bushes, becomes the president in the year 2000. He'll be able to run as a second-term governor. And then we're going back to Iraq. And then, you know, it was as simple as that. It was just, like, figure it out. And then, so I definitely remember on the radio, too. Oh, and I was right. Right, they nominated Bob Dole, who was like, couldn't
right.
possibly have beat Bill Clinton in a million years. So
right.
that reaffirmed. I thought I was smart anyway. I don't know if that's really how it happened or not. But anyway. And I predicted when he was the governor, I definitely said on the radio, and because I'll give credit to Till, the guy who also had a show on Free Radio Austin the next day. Mine was Wednesday at noon. He was Thursday at noon. And he would often call my show. And he interrupts right then and goes, and Afghanistan, too, they're going to have to go to Afghanistan because they're going to have to blame whatever terrorist attack on Osama bin Laden. And that's where he is now. And you have this whole propaganda campaign by Christiane Amanpour and all these people that demonize the Taliban, who, of course, Bill Clinton helped put in power in the first place. But anyway, and so all of 9/11 and the history of the Bush Jr. administration predicted right there on pirate radio in the ghetto in Austin in 1999.
So these were the pieces that you put together on
yeah,
the...
Yeah, okay. You know what it is? Like, I think being a conspiracy kook is not just fun. It's absolutely useful. Right?
I agree.
You have to just be able to tell the difference between speculation and jump into conclusions and really being right about something. And
yeah, it's all conspiracy.
Especially when it's predicting how things are going to play out. I mean, I don't know. I always thought that if only Yoda had ever just taken a cab, someone would have told him that, like, you know that the Chancellor is the Sith Lord, right? Dumbass. Where do you think the clone army came from? They've been planning this for 10 years, stupid. You know, but instead he's, like, floating around on his little ivory floaty chair, and he never got to hear the words of the people telling him the plain old truth or truth, you know?
Right. So I don't know if you did it all the way back then, but today you describe 9/11 as a kind of bait. Right?
Yeah.
Can absolutely. We talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, look, I mean, the whole thing absolutely was, one, motivated by American intervention, not radical Islam. I actually didn't even take time to debunk the radical Islam crap today because I just figured, you know, people understand now. It was the bombing of Iraq from Saudi that motivated it more than anything else, and support for Israel and their, you know, unholy oppression of the Lebanese and the Palestinians as well. And then support for the dictators, the King Fahd and Hosni Mubarak and the rest of the dictators America supports in the region, Abdul Saleh in Yemen. And then the strategy was to provoke America into overreacting and to getting itself bogged down, fighting in their sand trap. And bin Laden was a Leninist on this question. You know, if however many Somalis or Iraqis or Afghans have to die to succeed in bleeding America to bankruptcy, doesn't matter. I mean, he outright invoked the Afghan War of the 1980s when America was on his side. which is a war where the Soviets killed a million people.
Right.
A million Afghans died. And bin Laden was like, that's the model. That's what we want to do again, is the long game is, don't worry, let them die and let God sort them out. And if they're faithful, it'll be fine anyway. And at the end of the day, we'll finally bankrupt the Americans the way we did the Soviets and drive them out. And only then can we overthrow our kings and presidentes and dictators that America supports. And only then can we create our caliphate. And in fact, you know, you look at the recent history when Obama's plot to support al-Qaeda in Syria blew up into the Islamic State. What that was this group, ISIS, broke off, basically al-Qaeda in Iraq, broke off from al-Qaeda in Syria and al-Qaeda, the bosses hiding in Pakistan, wherever. And they said, we want to create our caliphate now. And then what did Obama do? He launched Iraq War III to drive them right back out of power again, which only proved to the letter that bin Laden and Zawahiri were right. That, no, you have to keep targeting the Americans until they are so bankrupt and exhausted that only then, when they're finally gone, only then can we create our caliphate. And so Obama just created the caliphate. And then in destroying it, he reinforced the message of bin Laden and Zawahiri, that this is how to unite all the different jihadists of the region, is against the enemy America, the far enemy that must be destroyed first. And so everything, you could call me a reverse 9/11 truther in this way. Bush had plenty of motive, obviously had plenty of motive to let 9/11 happen so he could take advantage of the crisis, as sure, a lot of people have accused. But just look at how powerful a motive Osama bin Laden had to do it. It wasn't because he hated you for being free. It was because he was trying to put your army and Marine Corps under his control to do his bidding, to do his dirty work. And as I quote in my talk, I mentioned the Jeff Huber article, Osama bin Laden, dead and loving it, because right at that time that Obama had just killed Osama in May of 2011, at that moment he's taking Osama's side in Libya and then moving on to Syria and helping back the jihadists there. And as I mentioned in the talk, it was just a brilliant stroke of luck. It was magic. It was maybe Jesus intervened and convinced the Sunni Arabs of Iraq to kill all the al-Qaeda guys. Aren't you sick and tired of them? And so even though George Bush had created thousands of new al-Qaeda guys with Iraq War II, the Iraqi Sunnis, their allies, turned on them and took care of them for us. Ah, sigh of relief, like you couldn't believe, right? And then what does Obama do? Obama saves them. Obama right. brings them back to life. And gives them their own damn country the size of Great Britain for 3 years. And I it's important to say this so people don't misconstrue. It's not because he's a secret Muslim from Kenya. It's because he's a secret Bill Clinton.
Sure.
He's Ronald Reagan. He's Bill Clinton. He's using the Mujahideen to do his dirty work. And as I explained in the talk, al-Qaeda isn't the American government's enemy in the Middle East. Iran is. Al-Qaeda doesn't stand in America's way. Al-Qaeda is useful for checking the power of Iran. At least they think. It keeps blowing up in their face, keeps backfiring and redounding in Iran's favor.
So you're talking a bigger picture, grand chessboard kind of way, what
right.
the real targets
are. Where our government
are.
Is willing to side with the American people's enemies, al-Qaeda, who have killed innocent American civilians and who helped kill 4,000 out of 4,500 killed by the Sunni insurgency in Iraq War II. Our government is willing to side with them against Iran, that never did anything to us, but stands in the way of America's monopoly dominant power in the Middle East.
Okay, so lots of people in my audience have probably read Brzezinski's book, Grand Chessboard.
Right.
Right. That's it's a good introduction to the larger game that's being played here. How do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, I think the guy's a complete lunatic.
Oh, that I agree with.
I mean, in a very irrational way, not just I disagree with him, but I think, you know, power really does corrupt mental facilities. And so you could have, and look, it's his jab, so you can't take that away from him, right? But mm-hmm. for anyone to prescribe that the middle part of North America must dominate all of Eurasia forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yes, it's true that, well, we're a naval power, like England, and we're from far away in North America. And so in order to dominate Eurasia, we're just going to have wars, and we're going to have a troop presence, and we're going to have to figure out ways to dominate this space. And then it's based on ridiculous syllogisms. Like, we have to dominate Afghanistan in southern Central Asia in order to make sure that Russia won't dominate Ukraine. Well, why don't you look at a map, Zabig? Because that doesn't follow at all. The Russians could easily dominate every stan and not Ukraine, or vice versa. They're not even on the same damn road to each other at all in any way. You know, we must dominate all of this land or Russia will.
Right.
So, and yet I just don't care, and I don't think the American people care, and I don't think the American people believe that the Constitution or that modern American popular politics mandate American domination of Eurasia forever and in order to prevent Russia from dominating its direct neighborhood. And I think if the policy was pitched that way to the American people, they would say, that's crazy. Have you ever seen a map of the world? Or, okay, never mind the Mercator map. Have you ever looked at a globe? The middle part of North America is supposed to dominate Eurasia for how long? Indefinitely? Only at the expense of everything that we care about.
Right. So we agree that he's insane.
As dumb as Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, who keep empowering Iran in order to spite them.
I'll tell you why I thought the book was so useful. And I wonder if you have examples of other books like this that people should read. Because I think if people are interested in the government corruption and U.S. foreign policy...
Ooh, read Fools, Aaron.
Okay, well, yeah, well, sure. But what's interesting, and I would even use that as a primer, the Scott Horton book, but to actually get inside the minds of people like Brzezinski or Kissinger or any of the neocons to see the scale on which they plan and think about the U.S. role in the world, it would be absolutely startling, I think, to the average American. And that was the experience that I had when I read that book maybe 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. Brzezinski also seemed to not know that when he was writing books that everybody would be able to read them.
Right.
Like, that was a problem that he had between, like, 1970 and the year 2000.
Right.
Because he said some pretty damning shit in a lot of his books.
Yeah,
early 70s.
Yeah.
So do you recommend that if people are interested in the work that you present, do you ever say, no, go get in the head of somebody like this. Go get in the head of Richard Perle. Go get in the head of Wolfowitz. Yeah.
And especially, you know, the more intellectual of the bureaucrats, like William Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, has a memoir about nuclear weapons at the nuclear brink right now. That's pretty useful. I've always wanted to read Robert Gates' memoirs, both of them, although I'm sure they're so full of BS. I mean, I don't know. But he certainly lived through a lot, so it would be interesting to see that. And you know what? Biographies, too. You don't know it, but you read the biography of some sports star from the 1940s and you learn a whole new thing about the world. You had no idea, not about sports, but about what was going on in the historical context in the country at the time and that kind of thing.
Awesome.
I mean, you know what I mean?
I totally agree with you.
You never know what in them.
So, unfortunately, we've made it to the airport and we're out of time, but thank you so much for, after flying in here, giving a speech, doing an interview, doing this with me, and I'm glad I finally got you on my show.
Thanks for the opportunity, man. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, Scott.
Hell yeah.
And plug the book and the website.
Again, for
book and the website.
On all this. Oh, the websites. So scotthorton.org for the show. Got all the interviews for you there, and they're on YouTube as well. Antiwar.com and libertarianinstitute.org, and the book is Fool's Errand. It's on Amazon, and the audiobook is out now too.
Awesome.
Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan.
And huge thanks to Joe for making this possible. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Yeah, Joe, appreciate it a lot. All right, here we go. Bonus question.
I missed my second flight of the day, so we're back on it.
This is kind of a loaded question because I already partially know the answer. How do you prepare for what you showed up here and did today as far as a speech like that?
Well, I've given this same speech a few times, so I actually didn't even bring any notes or anything. You know, it's really just a chronology, telling you everything you already know, but kind of in order and emphasizing the important parts for you kind of thing. So, I really didn't prepare at all as the answer. Other than just, I've been saying the same damn thing every day for a decade and a half or so. So that's pretty close, you know, that counts.
Well, see, but that's the interesting thing, though. It's not the same thing every day. Like, I used to listen to you when you were on every day, and it was what? It was like 3 hours at a time?
Well, you know what?
And you had guests, sure, and breaks, but it was a lot of time to have new stuff every day. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and there's always stuff happening and lots of great journalism being done, so that's lucky for me. But in terms of the story I'm telling, I mean, I'm basically telling the story of empowering Iran while trying to hurt them when they didn't even do anything to us anyway. And also indirectly and sometimes even directly empowering Al-Qaeda because the government prefers them to Iran, our enemies to their enemies. And so that's actually pretty easy. I mean, it really all just hinges around Iraq War II. And Paul Wolfowitz said, if we do this, it's going to be great. And then it turned out that, yeah, that wasn't right. And so this is what happened as a result of them doing what they were told to by him.
So you have a kind of a container of the narrative that you work inside, and that makes it easier to insert new pieces of information. Okay, this is actually something I want to talk about because, you know, one of the big themes on School Sucks is critical thinking. And one of the key aspects of critical thinking is taking, you know, various pieces of information from disparate sources that might have different biases or different agendas, reading through them and combining it into your own coherent narrative, free of, as much as possible, inconsistencies and contradictions.
Right.
So what is your workflow like to do this? Like, let's maybe focus on the time when you were doing a daily radio show. So you have the larger sort of overarching, you have the big picture. So you know what has to fit into the big picture. How do you go out before you get on the air, after you get on the air, collect the new information, especially when a lot of these stories, I mean, there's always news, but there's times when it's hotter and then there's times when it's quieter. So what is your like workflow process like for getting all this raw material and turning it into a coherent 2 or 3 hour broadcast?
Well, so one of my jobs is I'm the opinion editor of antiwar.com.
Right.
So that means I got to go find all these views, and Eric Garris also goes and finds a lot of views and read through them all and decide what we're going to run on the page tomorrow, basically, what we're going to approve as originals to run and what we're going to link to by other people and that kind of thing. So most mornings, my first, you know, couple of hours of the day is spent reading a lot of opinion pieces. And then, you know, every night I read the front page, all of Jason Ditz's work, the news editor at antiwar.com, and all the most important top news. And then I just actually got out of surgery where I got a Twitter chip implanted in my brain because I just do nothing but sit on Twitter all damn day, which it's almost like driving a cab where, like, one Friday night you have a $500 night and you're like, wow, you can really make money at this job. But, like, not really. No, you can't. You just had one good night. But that never happens, you know? Mm. And it's the same kind of thing with Twitter where it's a giant pile of garbage all day long. But then you're like, oh, man, look, what if I wasn't following the Jerusalem Post on Twitter? I might have missed this little nugget, you know? So it's got its little dopamine reinforcement mechanism thing going on there. It's pretty powerful, so I spend a lot of time on there.
How do you process and organize what you're reading on a daily basis?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a not very well-defined algorithm of what I hate the most, what's most timely and important, what other people are talking about, or what I think is really important in spite of the fact that no one else seems to think so or whatever. So, you know, like when I grade the views, I grade them good minus, good or good plus based on a lot of different factors of, you know, what I think is important and needs to be shown or not or what. So, you know, and honestly, man, every morning I wake up and this is probably not a good way to live. I read Mondo Weiss first thing every morning.
What is that?
Mondo Weiss is philipweiss.net. Philip Weiss runs it, mondoweiss.net. And it's basically Jewish liberal ex-Zionism, you know, American Jews who can't stand what Israel's doing now. And left, not really leftists, but like liberals.
Yeah.
not too far to the left, but just sick and tired of apartheid Israel. And Philip Weiss is a journalist going way, way back. He used to write for the New York Observer back, I don't know, in the 90s or whatever. And I'm not sure where he was before that. But he's just great. And he's got a great stable of writers over there, Palestinians as well. Dan Cohen and James North and all these people that ride over there, and they just keep such good track of what's going on with Israeli politics and American politics concerning Israel and the occupation in Palestine and all of that. So that's all really good. That's a definitely guaranteed way to start the morning off pissed off with coffee.
But so being pissed off is kind of your fuel.
That's my thing, man. Yeah, I quit smoking cigarettes, so I just got to double up on the hate.
Yeah, all right. So there's, I guess, two ways to look at what's happening in the world. There's a horizontal view, which is like this big picture that we're talking about, right? So being able to cross from one country to another or one conflict to another. But then there's also the thing I think that people would notice about your work is that there's also a vertical view, right? Like the, you can also go deep down into one thing if you need to. Mm-hmm. So that's like, now I know these are kind of difficult questions, Scott, because you've only ever used your mind. So it's, you know, to say like, oh, don't do it like that. Do it like this, like I do it. This is the only way you've ever done it. Because what you're talking about, one of the reasons why I think a lot of people think it's so impressive is it's so vast. There's so much stuff to know. And the terminology, like the grammar of it, is so literally foreign to so many people. But you can go across the horizontal. And then when you need to on a specific thing, you can go vertically into that thing pretty deep. Right. So that's what I'm looking for. Is there something? Is there a system that you use? Are you writing things down? Are you just trying to capture essence and you're, you know, you've got 100 tabs open you in front of you on the computer?
I look at what the job is basically, right? Like I have the ultimate cheat sheet in the world. Every report that I think is interesting, I get to get the reporter on and ask them any questions I want. And then I keep doing it for years and years and years and years and years in a row. So I don't have to read about what was happening in 2011. I remember covering it at the time. I remember explaining, you know, when Cy Hirsch wrote The Redirection about how the Bush team realized that, oh, man, we've just done so much for the Ayatollah. Now we got to tilt back toward Osama. I interviewed Hirsch about that article at the time. And mm-hmm. so, like, just because I'm old now and I've been doing this job for that long in a row that you know, it's like I get to take a college class and whatever I want on a daily basis, and I get to sit in the front row and interrupt and ask questions of whatever I right. want and whatever. So, you know, I have a huge advantage over regular people living their regular life and trying to get a handle on all of this stuff.
Indeed.
I mean, I'd be lying if I said I had much time to read books anymore. I used to always read, no matter what, at least one book a week, but usually two. And now I'm just... is Facebook and Twitter just ruin my brain, and I'm way, way worse at, you know, and which sucks too, because I want people to read my book, but I understand why they don't get to it, because I don't get to their book either, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I got a pile of two reads that one of these days I'm going to take a whole summer, what do they call it? A hiatus or whatever?
Sabbatical.
A sabbatical, yeah. I'll be like a professor and take a sabbatical and just go read a bunch of... I mean, I'll tell you, I read about 20 books about Afghanistan, 25 or something.
Yeah.
So, in doing that...
So, you use Facebook and Twitter as news aggregators, and you do the rest of this by yourself. Does anyone work for you? Does anyone help you?
Well, yeah. I have a volunteer named Aaron who helps me schedule all the interviews, which is a huge cheat. That, like, hey, Aaron, get me this guy and get me this guy and get me someone from the ACLU on whatever. Like, that is great. You know, he's really helpful. And then I've got a guy named Damon who is my primary editor, although he's off for the summer. And his buddy Sam and my buddy Phil are filling in, doing the editing and the posting of the interviews. If I had to edit and post all the interviews, I just wouldn't do it.
Oh, sure.
Or I'd do, you know, less than half of what I'm doing for sure.
Right.
So yeah, I've had a lot of great helpers over the years of people who helped me get my job done.
Cool. Bonus question. What was Scott Horton like in high school?
Skater punk, pothead.
What did your teachers think of you?
They all hated me at first.
Okay. Then what happened?
Well, yeah, you know me, man. I'm very charming. Sometimes.
How are your grades?
You know what, like A minus, kind of B plus, sort of. I never really had to work too hard, but also I never tried to work too hard either, because I...
And what did you think of it while you were there?
Well, you know, I went to a private school that was this tiny little house all full of hippies and anarchists and communist teachers.
Right.
Which, isn't that funny? It's like anarcho-communist teachers. And it's the only place you could get a real good leftist teacher is at a private school. And so high school was not so bad for me. I had 4-hour half days and a smoking section, and teachers all went by their first names, and classes were all really small, and it was really nice. So I can't complain about that. I think if any of my teachers from my private high school or any of the government schools I went to before that knew that I just did homework for a living, they would never believe it.
Like, right.
Wait,
right.
Scott Horton's job is doing book reports? Nah, that can't be right, but here I am.
What do you think of the school that most people in this country have to go through every day, most young people?
Well, it's a disaster, man. I mean, it should just be... You know, I'll tell you a story, actually. I remember seeing a rich... Oh, hearing a really spoiled, rotten, rich white kid call in talk radio and say, it's not fair that my rich parents have to pay for these poor Mexicans to go to school and win. And I just thought, like, if that's the case against public school, like, screw you, kid. You spoiled, rotten little brat, you know? And then I heard there was this guy named Jeff Davis who was on the Access Channel in Austin, who was just a kind of crusty old right-wing patriot type.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, hey, I'd abolish all the government schools because it's in the Communist Manifesto. And the government controls it, and the government wants to own your ass, and they're your enemy. And I was like, well, that's actually a lot better argument.
Sure.
You know, and then within like 2 weeks of that, this was like when I was in high school myself. I was, you know, 94, 93 or 94 or something. And then, but within just a couple of weeks of that, I heard like 6 nightmare stories about high school of, you know, teachers calling the cops on their student for something and they get charged with a felony and it's some nonsense, or a kid who gets expelled, the valedictorian gets expelled because there was a butter knife on the back floor of her car from where she was helping her parents move over the weekend, and the zero tolerance policy says that this is a weapon, and so now she can't be valedictorian and go to the college that she wanted to anymore.
You were hearing those stories back when you were in school?
Oh yeah, that was how it was in the 90s, and I just heard like 6 of these in a row. And I was like, dude, that crusty old right-winger is right. Like, there's just got to be a better way. Why should anyone think? I mean, we all have to eat. We all have to put gas in our trucks. We all have to do all kinds of different things. But we don't say, therefore, you have to have government do it. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. And, of course, when you know the history of where all this government schooling comes from, it's hardly about setting you free. And I think, you know, obviously education is huge. It's important. And the goal of educating children especially should simply be to make them the best people you can make them, so that then when they're an adult, they can decide what to do with their life themselves and make the best choices for themselves. Not train them up their whole childhood to, you know, work a specific job or have a specific outlook and that kind of thing. I hate that. When I was actually in government school in elementary school, that was what they taught us about communism. You know,
that it trains you in a narrow focus, and
yeah,
it's interesting.
They pick your job for you. They and all of a sudden, of course, the irony was lost on all of us that we're in what's probably one of the most communist parts of the American system discussing this.
Yeah, but, you know, so it's interesting too. You know, what you do is so big picture, and I remember learning about history in public school, which obviously, like a foundation, like a real education in history, would be so helpful in understanding the current condition of, you know, U.S. foreign policy or international relations. But it's incomprehensible to most people because big pictures are very hard to see. And to take smaller pictures and try to integrate them into a whole, like, which is something that, you know, you're trying to do, explaining foreign policy to people, or even, you know, smaller pictures and integrating them into a whole that is the war in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
That's not a skill that people develop in public school, and very few people develop it in college either. I didn't. Like,
well, I just fighting, yeah. And I hate losing, so, you know, I have to make sure I got my I's dotted and T's crossed.
Well, absolutely. And I'm wondering,
what if somebody, like, called me out for getting a fact wrong? I would hate that.
I'm wondering if that's something that you picked up in an alternative private school, right? Did you have more control over your education, your learning, than what most kids have in public school?
Nah, not really, but I did, and this is something I mentioned in the last interview I did with Lou there, too, was I had a great history teacher.
Yep.
Who was, she was really an anarcho-syndicalist, and she taught us all about the CIA and all about the NSC 68 even, you know, and the dawn of the Cold War and the World Empire and all of this stuff. So I had a really great introduction to, this is not your security force, man. They call themselves that, but there's something else going on here from a real young age. You know, Star Wars really radicalized me, too. The very first thing I learned about politics was the Emperor just dissolved the Senate. Because he's so good at killing people now, he doesn't even need to pretend to listen to anybody else kind of thing. That's, you know, so, and like I think I mentioned, Reagan drug wars and Clinton burning Waco and all of these things. So, I guess a lot of people, you know, I read a thing that said that millennials see everything through the lens of Iraq, but I don't know exactly what that means. I mean, if that means that everything is lies and it's everything's a disaster and you can't believe any of these sons of bitches ever, then good. But I'm not sure if that's what it means to them or not. It certainly should, since Iraq War II was the Waco massacre times literally 100,000 or something.
Right. Well, I hate to end on a down note, but we're almost out of time and I want to give everybody a chance to decompress, and I'm glad we got in a couple extra questions even though they're not under the best circumstances. And it was
great circumstances.
Okay. All right.
I'm happy to do it. I'm glad we got to.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for doing it, Scott.
Buy my book, everybody.
Give the title again.
Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan.
Awesome.
All right, we're good.